All right, welcome to class today. Before I begin, are there... Oh, I forgot my microphone.
Where is my microphone?
Before I begin, are there thoughts, comments, questions, or other things for me?
Okay. So, when last we left off, we were just talking about how two ways that processors are fancier than pipelines. So we're going to look at some challenges of those two ways, then see how we're going to solve those challenges, and then come back and see how this is going to let us write faster code. That's the basic outline for the day. So here is one of the two techniques we talked about. This is one of the techniques called out-of-order execution, where we're allowed to start executing or complete executing the third instruction before the first and second have finished. There's an implied delay here that caused the first add to take a while to decode because of whatever was before it, and then has this sort of ripple down effect thereafter. One of the challenges we have here that we didn't have with regular forwarding is we have a new kind of hazard, or a new manifestation, I guess, of the hazard. In the past, when we were forwarding, suppose I want to forward the value of R8 to my execute stage, the way you implemented your pipeline forwarding is you looked at the stage that had previously written this that's in your pipeline. But if we do that for this instruction, by the time this add queue is executing, the previous instruction in the pipeline was three instructions ago instead of one instruction ago, because one instruction ago is finished. It's that basic logic we used with some muxes to check out which value was most recent and use that instead. That kind of forwarding won't work. We now want to forward instead from this point forward. That's the correct forwarding. Except that may not actually be there, so maybe we want to read directly from the register file and not forward at all. And so we have this extra complication in our forwarding logic when things are out of order. It's insufficient to just look at the pipeline registers. We need more information. We need some historic information about what order things ran in. We also looked at multiple issue, where I have multiple instructions happening at the same time. If I combine this with out of order, I can get, it's easier to get these other weird scenarios. So this is a kind of hazard we didn't have to worry about in our previous pipelines. This is what we call a write after write hazard. I am writing the first instruction after another instruction has already written to that same address. That same destination, rather, not address. And so this isn't even a forwarding problem, this is a commit problem. The problem here is that I might end up putting the older value in the register over top of the newer value. So I have to think about a fancier way of forwarding, and I also have to think about a fancier way of handling the order in which things happen at the end, so that I can end up having my instructions getting into the right registers and the right second next instructions as I'm going along. So this is going to require us to rethink the basic organization of our pipeline, as it turns out. The system we've used thus far will keep using pipelines in various places, and we'll see some places later. We're going to change the organization of our pipeline to be more complicated. This is Professor Rice's illustration of what we might consider an out-of-order pipeline. OOO, out of order. And this phrase, this abbreviation will show up from time to time. So let's walk through this. I know everybody loves a good pipeline diagram. Huzzah! All right, let's work through one bit at a time. Some of this, I think you'll find fairly familiar. We have an instruction cache, which fetches instructions. The pipeline register before that would tell me something about the program counter. Where am I looking, right? I would fetch instructions, and because it's multiple issue, I would fetch multiple instructions. And so this pipeline register after my instruction fetch would have multiple instructions that I've all split apart into different pieces. I'm also going to need some sort of branch prediction. And actually, my branch prediction is going to become much more important. Because of the complication we're adding to our pipeline, a branch misprediction might cost us 15, 20 cycles instead of just 2 or 3. And we'll talk some more about why that is as we get into how the later parts work. So we actually have 2 levels of branch prediction. We're doing 1 branch prediction immediately, and then a 2nd branch prediction when we get a little bit more information as we decode the instruction. Because if we can get our branch prediction better, we will save more cycles. You'll notice here I have decode, and then later on I have register read. The decode stage needs to understand the instructions. And when I'm fetching a lot of instructions, that becomes some actual work. Right? To figure out where the boundaries are and move between them and so on. And so that's what we're going to call our decode stage. Then I have new things. We'll come back to the new things. I have write back. Hooray, I have write back. Going to a register file. And I have this new commit stage. So most of this is new stuff. The first thing we have here is what we're going to call a register rename stage. Okay? So the challenge we have in these previous hazards is that knowing I am writing to R8 is not enough to put it in the right place. This R8 and this R8, I need to know more than just they're both R8 and which one came last to make them work. Similarly for my forwarding, it's not enough to know simply I want to forward from R8. I need to know which R8 I'm going to forward from. And so the way we're going to handle this is by effectively changing all register names to new names that don't conflict. And so that's what the rename stage is doing. I think perhaps the easiest way to go through rename first is to just go through an example. So here is a very simple bit of code. I am summing up 4 registers. R8, R10, R11, and R12 are all being summed up into R8. And as we're going through this, we're going to want to distinguish between 2 kinds of registers. We're going to have what we'll call our architecture registers, because these are the one in our instruction set architecture. These are the ones that you've been learning about all semester. These are the ones that are in your assembly. These are the ones that show up in my code. But I'm also going to have these other registers, my physical registers. So inside the actual processor, I'm never going to use the architectural registers. I'm going to instead turn them into these other fancy registers, which Professor Rice likes to call with an X. There's not a standard notation for them because I can't annotate them. They cannot appear in assembly. But for simplicity of presentation, we're going to use a similar syntax we would for the architectural registers. We'll just use this X to suggest there's something special about them. And so what I have here in my register map is saying, when you read code that talks about RIX, you should actually use the physical register 4. And we have this lookup table. So as I decode an instruction and want to understand what is it referring to, I can go to my register map and say, ah, this first instruction talks about R10 and R8. Those are not the registers I am actually using. I'm instead actually using the physical registers. So what I'm really doing here is I am adding on my X, 10 is 19, and my X 13. So there's going to be this stage where I'm going to rename my registers from the architectural registers to my physical registers instead. This by itself won't fix our problem. The remaining piece we're going to do is we're going to use new registers for everything. So x86 typically uses an argument as the destination for a lot of the arithmetic type of operations. We're going to change that. In our physical instructions, we're going to write to a 3rd register. And the 3rd register, because I'm writing it, it was not any of the previously existing values. I'm going to make a new version of register 8. And so I'm going to go to my free register list, and I'm just going to grab the 1st free register. And I'm going to say, I'm going to put that value into this new register. So I'm going to add the existing x19 and x13 and put it into x18. That's no longer free. I'm now using it. And for every subsequent instruction, when you see R8, I don't mean X13 anymore. I now mean X18. And so by doing this rename, I now can guarantee that a later instruction refers to the correct previous instruction's version of the result. So as I keep going here, now I'm adding R11 and R8. So R11, that becomes R11 is X7. And R8 is currently X18. And then, because it is producing a value, it's going to produce a value into the next free spot. And I'm going to come down here and say, oh, in the future, it's not X18 anymore, it's now X20. And then I come down to this next one, and this is adding R12, which was X5, and R8, which is currently X20. And it's putting into yet another free thing, X21. And I'm going to change this to say X21. Question?
So, like, as you go through the chain of register I's, do those registers get added back to the free register?
Yeah, so eventually I'll decide these registers are free. How will I know they're free? Sorry? After the commit, it's actually a little more complicated than this, because although I'm changing the register number for my R8 over and over again, you notice that my R10, R11, R12 haven't changed. So register becomes free once it is not in the register map and not needed by any operating instruction. But that just means I need to check a bunch of registers and see if it's there. This is basically a big and. I can do that. Yes?
So are the physical registers that are being mapped to in this call, are those like default mapping?
You mean like how did I come up with these numbers?
Yeah.
This is just whatever happened after running the program for a while. There's no intrinsic meaning to any of the physical registers. There's just a bunch of them. Yes?
How does that mean the name of the register will have like 6 until 16 registers?
Yeah, why would I have more physical registers than architectural registers? I do have more, right? I've got an X19 there, but there's only 16 architectural registers. Why would I have more? Yes? Oh, you're going to ask a different question. I'll come back to you. Yeah?
Is there more than one version of the architecture
registry? Yeah, at any given point in time, right, assuming I'm partway through my pipeline, it's likely all three of these instructions are still running. So it's likely all four of these physical registers are needed at once. And so in general, I'm going to need many more physical registers. Recent versions of Intel have on the order of 200 physical registers for their 16 architectural registers. So we need this because we're using several at the same time. Question? How does this help solve our problem? Great question. So before I get to how this helps solve the problem, any questions about what's happening? Yes? It's just a register on the hardware. So what's happening here is in my assembly, I want register number 8. And I'm saying I'm not going to use register number 8. I'm going to use some other physical register number instead. And so this means that the registers, as we think about them in architecture, are just a way of encoding dependencies between instructions. And I'm going to encode them differently in the actual hardware. So these physical registers, these architectural registers, are not physical. They are not actually a thing. They are merely an illusion I provide the programmer while I do something else. Similarly to how, in my pipeline, there isn't really a point in time in my assembly. Right? I say I do this instruction and then that instruction, but that's just an illusion I'm giving you. I'm really doing a bunch of things at once. And this is another illusion I'm giving you. I'm giving you an illusion of 16 registers. But there's really more of them, and I'm using them differently. Yes?
So after X13 is underneath, does it join like the free register?
Correct. Yep. And so this free register list will actually be implemented under the hood using something called a circular queue, which is fairly easy to implement in architect in hardware. And we'll just pop them on the push them on the end, and everything goes. Yes?
Things out of order, so we might need to keep track of this value at this time, this value at this time, and access those simultaneously?
This is the right intuition. We'll get back to why we're doing this in just a moment. Let me make sure we understand what we're doing first, though. Yes?
So, like, when register 13 goes back into the pre register list, does it go back below all the ones that are already there? Or?
It actually doesn't matter where I put it in there. If it's free, it's free. There's no meaning to the numbers. So it's, I haven't looked at the most recent hardware, but many hardware put it at the end because they had ways of sort of shifting it up, and that happened to work out right. But if they found a fit way to put it on the front or in the middle, that would work just as well. As long as it's in the free list, only if it's free, and not if it's not, then we're good to go. Yes?
Are all the physical registers at the same file?
Are all the physical registers, sorry?
At the same file.
Are they all in the same file? We don't have to put them in the same file, but for the way we're describing it, we are. Yes?
So, like, for the example that you gave, so, doing the forward from, X30 to X80.
Great question. So this comes back to what we're doing with it. So let me come back to that in just a moment. Yes?
In the pipeline diagram, is it only accounting for out of order, or does it also account for multiple issues?
So we're going to do multiple issue and out of order with the same tool. So this will do both of those for us. All right, let's go look at why we're doing this. Let's come back to the problems we had. So a problem we had here is that we had three uses of R8. And if I do the naive kind of forwarding, the kind of forwarding you learned how to do, where I just look in the pipeline register for where was this value last present, then I would grab the wrong one. But if I rename these will have different names, right? The destination of this will be X something. I don't know. Maybe it's X17. The source of this then will be X17, but it will write to X, I don't know, maybe X20. I'm pulling these numbers out of thin air. And so then this one, this actually doesn't even have a source. This isn't a source either, is it? This is just a destination. Right? And this is also just a destination. And so when I'm running this actual code, I will realize not only do I not have to worry about running in the right order, but I actually don't even have any dependencies on X8. Every use of X8 in this instruction is conceptually distinct. There's no data dependencies between them. And so I don't have to worry at all about the order I do them in, about handling them in the right way. My register renaming will handle getting data to where it belongs correctly. And this will recognize that that's coming from this, and it's going to whatever it's going to. And so it will recognize there's actually only one data dependency here. And for any given instruction, I can now go back to my old forwarding rule. My old forwarding rule is just look in the pipeline register, and if it's available, use that. And I can use that again. So that one had no data dependencies. This one also has this idea where I have a sort of fake data dependency, right? But this is actually going to read from something and write to something. This is going to only write to something else. And this is going to read from that thing and write to something else. And because I'm going to rename them appropriately, I'm going to know where I need to forward. And all of that forwarding logic we designed for the simple in-order pipeline, which probably didn't seem simple before we added this complexity, but compared to this is simple, all of that forwarding logic we can just use. It's now, again, the correct logic. Because if I see a physical register, it has the meaning I expected from the in-order single-issue situation. Yes?
Does renaming happen according to the order of the instruction, or does it happen to the order of the actual?
I always want to rename from in the order the instructions appeared, because that is the data dependency the programmer intended.
Okay.
Yes? No?
Still thinking about it.
Okay. Other questions? Yes? How do I keep track of the data dependencies? How do you do that as a human? How do you know whether there's a data dependency between two instructions? Maybe you don't. Turn to whoever you're sitting next to and see if you can explain how a human could identify data dependencies. Does anybody have an explanation they think is worth sharing with the class? How do we detect data dependencies? Yes? Yep. Is the register I'm reading from something I wrote to earlier? If so, I have a data dependency. Except, we have this extra earlier to a human has a fancier meaning. I'm only dependent on the most recent write. It not a write before that write. Okay? And then these things also chain. There's a transitive property to them. Where if one instruction depends on another, and that one depends on a third, and the first one has this indirect dependence on a third. That's the meaning of data dependence. The register renaming removes the extra of most recent. Because every write occurs to a new register. So I don't have to worry about most recent. There will only be one write to any register. Because every time I have a destination register, I'm going to allocate a new free register. And so now all I care about is, do I have a source that anything else has a write on? If so, there's a data dependency. If not, there's not. And because I got rid of this earliest notion, I now can just check by effectively XORing register numbers between different instructions and seeing if they come out to zero. Right? Are they the same register number or not? And now I know if there's a data dependency. Yes?
I think I have my question now as well.
Yeah.
If we're doing out of order, it's possible that our execution order is not the same as the order that the instructions are listed in, right?
Correct.
And so, like, in the last slide you were showing, where we have the we're fetching the appropriate register.
This one?
Right, yeah, the correct reading register X3 from the previous instruction. Like, how would we know?
Yeah, so this gets a very important point. You're saying we can run the instructions in a different order than is written in the code. We can run parts of them in a different order. But we're going to fetch them in order. Well, I might have some branch mispredictions. But modulo branch prediction, I'm going to fetch them in the order they appear in the code. I'm going to therefore sort of start the work, do the renaming in the order they appear in the code. It's only after I've renamed things that I'm free to start shuffling them around. Because before I rename them, the order I do the renaming is important to preserve the dependencies. So if we look at our system here, alright, so the place that things go reorder is where I create this queue, which is not really a queue in the 2150 sense. It's a pool of instructions, sort of like a priority queue. Okay, and we'll actually talk about how this works in a moment. The idea here is, once I get an instruction renamed, I can then put it in this system that says, here's an instruction that needs handling sometime. And whenever the resources are available to run it, I'll start running it. Whenever it gets stuck, I'll pause it, keep it going. So the portion that happens in or out of order is this portion. So this portion is out of order. But the rest of it, these parts, happen in order. And the job of commit is to get us back in order at the very end. Yes? Yes. This one? Why do we not to need rename? Sorry, why do I need rename which one? Why am I not giving it a new source? Because it's not a source in this instruction. Immediate register move, the register is only a destination. So I'm only renaming its destination. So I am renaming it, but it's only being used for one purpose, so it gets only one new name. All right. So, this magic will turn complicated instructions into simple-ish handling. where I don't have to worry about most recent, least recent. I just have to worry about, does it have the same name? I think we may skip this one. The point of this is just that the number of instruct... Well, let's go ahead and briefly go through this. The idea here is that each of these will have a different number of things renamed. So this add, this is used for two things, right? I've got two sources going to a new destination. Okay? But not all of them have that characteristic. So a register memory move, both registers are sources. And there is a destination, but it's not a register. It's memory instead. And this is going to make our work more complicated because we have to handle somehow getting our memories in the right order. So let's go ahead and briefly run through this. R10 is going to become X16. R8 is going to become X13. And we're going to pop this into X18. Then this one is going to move from whatever... and this is now X18. Right? Because that's the one I wrote to. So this move is going to grab from X18, and it's going to grab from its other its other source is X4 from RA, and then it's going to write to memory. So this register renaming handles our register activity as well, but doesn't handle our memory activities. And so if we have multiple memory activities, we're going to need to worry about how we're going to keep those in order. We'll see that here when we get to MR move queue. So let's go ahead and do our subtraction. Our subtraction is going to grab from the current value of R8, which is X18, and the current value of R11, which is X7. And it needs a new destination, which will be X20, which will become the new version of R11. But now I have a memory register move. So for this, I have a move. It is taking 8 plus some register value. And so that register is now this X20 that I just created. And its destination, this one is not used. That's a new destination. So its destination is going to be the next free spot I have. Okay, but now I have a problem. This is memory. And I have no guarantee whether X4 and 8 plus X20 will be the same address in memory or not. Depends on the individual values in X4 and X20. They may be distinct points in memory, in which case there's no dependence between these instructions. Or they may be the same address in memory, in which case there is a dependence between these instructions. And I can't tell from looking at the assembly what that is. So if we're building an out-of-order processor, our memory is going to have to be more complicated. There are, broadly speaking, two solutions I could do. The simpler one is I have two options. One is I could do memory in order. I could say all memory accesses are dependent on all other memory accesses. They always have to wait, do them in the right order. Okay. The other thing I could do is I could actually compare real addresses. Once I compute the real address, I could compare it to other real addresses that are in flight and see is there a dependency or not. Doing the comparison of real addresses makes our hardware more complicated, but also gives us higher utilization, less false dependency. Because most memory accesses in real code are not dependent on recent memory accesses. Most of them are independent. It is unusual within a few instructions to access the same address twice. Usually, if we are going to do that, we would pop them into a register and use the register. And so this comparing addresses will often find there's no conflict and often allow us to run a little bit more quickly. So modern hardware will typically do the comparison of addresses. There's all kinds of weird gotchas to how that works. As I understand it, this is not something we will ever cover in this class. You should just sort of vaguely know it's possible. And if you want to learn more, you can take CS4330, which will dive into these topics in more detail. All right. We also have some other IRMove queues, NAD queues, and we've actually already talked about IRMove queue, which has only a destination like memory does. So, questions? Yes?
In the fourth line, why are we replacing 20 to 21?
Why did I replace 20 to 21? So that happens here when I am writing to R11. And every time I write, I allocate a new register.
But every time you read, you don't allocate.
When I read, I don't. When I write, I do. Yes? Memory register move does not read its destination. Right? So different instructions that look the same might treat some of their arguments as sources or destinations or both. So you have to understand the instruction to know how it gets translated. Other questions? All right. Let's see if this stuck in. Do this yourselves! Thank you.
All right. How are we feeling? We're not feeling. Okay. Questions? Yes.
You still need to reassign the physical register for R10 when we're only moving a constant.
Do I need a new physical register for R10 when I'm only putting a constant into it? Great question. What do you think? Yeah. So there could be an optimization. The compiler could have optimized away the move 100 into R10 and then just put the subtract 100 from R8. But the compiler didn't do that. And so we have to assume the compiler didn't do that for some reason. Perhaps R10 is going to be used 100 instructions in the future. So the processor, the hardware, is welcome to try doing things more efficiently, but it's not allowed to skip doing things we asked it to do. Other questions? Yes?
What does the arrow mean in the previous slide when you rename?
I mean, I'm trying to write a destination, but my assembly doesn't have the notion of a separate destination. So I'm saying this is the destination. Because that it was compounded with a source in the original.
They're converting a two operator to three operands.
Right. Usually. Although for something like this move, it's two on both sides. So I'm just using the arrow to say that's the destination to keep myself straight about what destination is compared to source.
So if you're implementing register, you have to take account of A, what the store has to see.
Correct. And you sort of already did, right? You have a destination register and a source register already in your pipeline. We already sort of tease apart the dual purpose registers. And so we're just doing that more formally here. Other questions? Okay. So, this is part of what we want to do. This is the register renaming phase. We've got other things. We have an instruction queue. We have this weird combination execution memory stage that we're going to need to talk about. But first, let's just talk about some extra tweaks we could do because we're renaming instructions anyway. There are some instructions that require weird extra work, like push and pop, that are both handling registers and memory and UGG. While we're renaming registers, we could also rename instructions. And so, for example, modern Intel-based architectures will take pop and turn it into two instructions. Because that's what pop means, two instructions. And then they'll translate those. It turns out that we can also use this to deal with other weirdness, like our condition codes. Instructions can depend on each other because they have condition code dependencies. Well, that's just another register. We can rename the invisible condition codes argument as a physical register, just like everything else. And so by having this process we're renaming anyway, we can use this to make an architecture for a simpler instruction set than the actual instruction set. And because of this, we have this idea of what are called micro-operations. Okay? Micro-operations are the instructions the hardware implements, which conceivably could be completely unrelated to the instructions that are in the assembly. Usually just take some of the complicated parts and make them simpler. Right? And so what I'm actually going to handle may not have pops, and it may not have condition codes. It may only have physical registers and ands and moves. But I can add to this renaming stage, the sort of this decoding, where I'm going to turn one instruction into two. And so this process here is part of what decode does. And then I have rename. And I can even be cleverer than this. If we look over here, I have a data dependency between these two instructions. But I don't have to have a data dependency there. I could instead rewrite this as being dependent on the same source. So because I'm doing my renaming, I can take the easy rename and instead make it this slightly more fancy rename that will save me a data dependency and allow me to do things faster. So there's this whole ongoing process. Once we have renaming in place, we can evolve the instructions the hardware is running based on whatever is efficient for the hardware, while we keep the assembly more or less constant for the programmer. And this gives us this extra power and extra freedom in designing our architecture. Yes?
So can you go up against how we cannot have a, or how we can make it so we don't have a data dependency?
Yes, these two instructions do not have a data dependency. Why not? The thing written here is not a source. I don't have to read what I wrote. Because I'm going to compute my address based on the old instead of the new. Right? I can't even really write that here. Right? That's sort of like I want to move 8 RSP minus 8. It doesn't even make sense in the physical architectural registers. But in the physical registers, because they're now separate, I now have that ability. Other questions? All right. With the mechanism of renaming, I now have the ability to implement my out-of-orderness and potentially my multiple-issueness as I wish. So let's sort of work through how this works. Here I have the instruction queue. It has a priority. We want to do the first instruction first, because in general, the order the programmer gave us things is going to be a wise order to operate in. But I'm not always going to do that. I want to do the earliest, as many ready instructions as I can. An instruction is ready if its physical registers are ready. Its physical registers are ready if I've already written a value to them. So every time an instruction writes a value to a register, that value becomes ready. And technically, we could also do some forwarding to say they're ready a little earlier if we have good forwarding going on. And so let's imagine we have here two complete ALUs. They can run any instruction. We've done the renaming. We want to try to use them so we can run two instructions at once. So the first thing we're going to do in any given cycle, let's consider cycle one. Okay? In cycle one, I want to try to run the first instruction if I can. So the first thing to check is it ready? X1 is ready, X5 is ready, so instruction one is ready, so I'm going to run instruction one and take it off of my queue. And then I want to check to see, is instruction two ready? Physical register two is ready, but physical register six is not, so I can't run instruction two, because I don't have the value of X2 yet. Instruction 3 needs X7, which is not ready. Needs X8, which is not ready. Needs X9, which is not ready. X8, which is not ready. 9, this is the only one I can run. So this one is just going to sit here idle. This instruction, I can only use one of my two ALUs. So I go on to my next cycle. Let's assume we have a single cycle ALU for now. We'll get to more complicated ALUs here in a moment. But that means in cycle 2, X6 is now ready. Because I have written to X6. And so now when I come down, I can say, instruction 2 is ready. So I can take it off of my instruction queue. But it turns out everything else depends on 7 or above. So that's the only one that's ready. Question? It depends on whether the data for that physical... So, there's two statuses, I guess you could say. The status of a register depends on if the value has been placed there yet. So it just depends on, has it been written? Remember, each register is written only once because of renaming. So we don't have to worry about all of the writings happen. There's only one write to deal with. And so if it's been written, it's ready. If it hasn't been written, it's not. And then an instruction is ready if all of its sources are ready. Other questions? Yes?
So if you had in the first instruction, it was X1 and X2, and then the second one was X3, X4, you could theoretically put them in...
Correct. Correct. I could do them both at once. They have two ALUs, they'd both be ready. Unless you see a case of that in a later cycle, where we'll have multiple ready at once. Yes?
If at 6 we're not ready, then you we're ready, but your instruction destination is at 6 at instruction 1. Will you set it to not ready?
It is impossible, if we've done a renaming write, to ever have a pending write on a ready register. Every physical register is written it by exactly one instruction, and it's not ready until we've run that instruction. Now, eventually, we'll sort of get past the instruction, and it'll go back in the free registers space, which will be pending again. So we will change it back to pending. We'll change it back to pending once it's free, meaning nothing else depends on it. Other question? Yes?
You're executing at most 2 instructions per cycle?
Because I have 2 ALUs, yes.
So do you fetch 2 instructions per cycle?
Yep. I fetch 2 instructions per cycle in order to prepare for that. Yes? Yeah, so it turns out that probably your laptop has 4 per core, probably. But they're going to be a little bit more complicated than a single ALU, so we'll talk some more about that right at the end of class day. Yes? Yeah, it means I'm using that as a condition code. Just a shorthand for the purpose of that, because saying it's got a destination for a compare is probably a little odd. It's reminding we're using it as a condition code. Okay, let me just quickly run through the next. So, this will all happen. This will become ready. I can't run anything else that cycle. In cycle 3, I now have 1 through 7 are ready, so I can do instruction 3, because it's got 3 and 7. I can't do 4. I can't do 5. That's the only one I can do. Okay, so that one finishes, and 8 becomes ready, and now I'm in instruction 4. And this is the first time I believe I can do 2 things. Because instruction 4 is ready to execute, but so is instruction 6. Because both of them depend only on ready registers. And so I'm going to go ahead and queue 4, and I'm also going to queue 6. Note here, this is an already made a branch prediction for me. Because I have a jump before that. And if I mispredicted my jump, I may do quite a bit of incorrect work before I figure that out, depending on how the data dependencies worked. Okay, but for now we're going to assume we correctly predict it, and instruction 6 is the right instruction. Right, so those will finish, and then that means I'm going to have 9 ready and 10 ready, and then in my next step I can do both 7 and 8, because they only depend on ready registers. And then in my next step, that means that 11 and 12 will be ready. And then in my final stage for this set, I can do instruction 9. Question?
Why were you able to do instruction 4 when X09 was still pending?
Because it's a destination, not a source. Right? And I only care about the sources to decide if I can do my instruction. Yes?
So when do we... Because if register 9 is ready after...
I just completely skipped instruction 5. I should have done 5 and 7 here. Thank you. And 8 and 9 here. Yep. Yes. Thank you. Yes. Can the instruction queue overflow? If I don't have room for more instructions in my instruction queue, I just stop fetching. Or I stall the fetch stage until there's room to put them in. Or I could do stall. I might actually be able to stall the rewrite phase, or wherever it is I'm filling this in, I'll stall that, and potentially I'm back the line if there's nowhere to store things. Other questions? Yes? Has the priority? Yeah, it has them in the priority order of the order fetching, and then as I remove things anywhere from them, I'll ripple the other things up. So I've just been crossing them out, but really I won't cross them out. I'll move everything up, so that the new first priority one is now number 1 again, and so on. All right. So this allows us to execute instructions. Things get more complicated if I have different kinds of functional units. So let's come back here, and I should have done this earlier. You notice my execute stage? I have ALU1, ALU2, a two-stage ALU3, and a load store. And this is a common kind of thing to do. Some portions of the ALU we use a lot. We do addition for dozens of instructions. We only do memory accesses for a very small number. Multiplications, where it's a math that takes multiple cycles in practice, they only appear once in a while. So we might have a few. We can split these out. We can have whatever we think is useful. And our system will then not only think about is it ready, but also is a functional unit ready to schedule it. So let's take a brief little look at what this looks like. In my first cycle, I can clearly run instruction 1, because 4 is ready. But that has to go not in the ALU, it's a memory move. It goes in the data cache slot. Instruction 2 is also ready, but my data cache slot is full. It is busy. So instead of scheduling instruction 2, the instruction's ready, but the processor isn't, I'm going to go on to instruction 3 for my ALU. And so I'm going to schedule instructions based on if they're ready and if I have capacity to run them in. And while this is more complicated for a human to deal with, it's actually a little easier for the computer, the hardware, to deal with, because I can use the iCode to decide what I need to check. Instead of having to check all the functional units, I can check the iCode and say, oh, this only has one functional unit possible. And so it actually simplifies to some degree the hardware, while at the same time giving me the flexibility of not duplicating hardware I'm not using and giving more copies of the stuff that's very popular. Yes?
So each cycle, do we go through each instruction and the instruction key to see if it can...
Correct. Each cycle, I go through in order, from the earliest to the latest, and chat until I fill up all of the available slots or run out of instructions. Correct. At this point, I have stopped going down. I would stop going down. 2 is available, is ready, but I'm not going to schedule it because I don't have another data cache. These two don't happen to be ready, but even if both of them were ready, I wouldn't schedule either of them either because I don't have another ALU. Yes?
Do you need for either 1 or 3 to finish before you can execute 2?
Right. They have to get out of the exit. So not just 1 or 3. I need 1 to finish before I can execute 2. Because I need my data cache to be available for another instruction. The ALU being available won't help me. And so, Mark, in my next cycle, right, this will mean that 6 becomes ready and 8 becomes ready. Right? And both of these, because I'm assuming it's one cycle axis, both of these are available again. And so that means I'm going to definitely put instruction 2 in my data cache. I'm going to put instruction 4 in my ALU. And in the final cycle, I will only have instruction 5 because I don't have anything left to... I don't have any other instructions for my data cache. Yes?
So in reality, though, here we're assuming there's one cycle for the data cache, but like different components might be taking different numbers of cycles.
Absolutely. So your data cache in particular is going to be organized in such a way that you'll put an instruction there and it will just tell you when it's ready for the next one. It may sit there for 100 cycles on that one instruction. But I actually don't have to do any special things to make that happen. I just keep it busy until it's not busy, and then it'll grab the next available instruction. Other questions? Okay. Now, pipelining. We have an overall pipeline, but we can also pipeline a single instructional unit. For example, most PCs have a multiplier that is, an integer multiply is typically either 3 or 4 pipeline stages, just for the multiply. So if I think just about multiplying in a 3-stage pipeline for the multiply, and I want to compute A times E times C times D, how many cycles will this take? This is not using any of our recent stuff, except that it's only about multiply, right? We're just dealing with this pipeline to execute. I want a number. Well, it's the number of cycles it will take. Work on this for a minute, then we'll talk about it. I got 9 cycles. Questions? Yes?
So would sequence B happen in stage 1 and then have to go all the way through?
No, I have a 3-cycle multiply. So C times D takes 3 stages. It goes through the ALU1 stage, then the ALU2 stage, and the ALU3 stage. And then I have C times D. And so because I have a data dependency, I need the result. I can't start B times until later. Okay? Now, I can change this simply by moving my parentheses. If I parenthesize as A times B times C times D, now I can take advantage of the pipelining. Okay? So this one, my A times B goes ALU1, ALU2, ALU3, and then it's ready. My C times D does not have a data dependency on that. So as soon as the first stage of the ALU pipeline is open, it can start executing. And then I have to wait for both of those to become available before I can do that final multiply. And so, instead of 9 cycles, I just have 7. So this is an optimization known as reassociation. If I can change my parentheses without changing the math, but changing the amount of data dependencies, my processor can run them faster. Particularly, it's worth, as a side, noting, for floating point numbers, your compiler will not do this for you. Because reassociation will change the rounding behavior of floating point numbers. So you have to pick the right association. For integers, it will do it for you, but for floating points, it won't. So you have to pick your own association if you want to get this kind of parallelism out of your hardware. Yes?
Is A1, 2, 3, are they the same register? Are they the same ALU or different?
No, they're the 3 stages of my ALU.
So there's
a pipeline register between each of them.
So they are 3 ALU physical ALU.
They are 1 ALU that is pipelined to do its work in 3 stages. So for example, if I give you big numbers to multiply, it is likely one of the things you do is write them out the right way. And then you sort of do a place at a time. And then you add them up. If we think about our ALU doing a similar work, I could say, this does the layout and the first 2 single-digit multiplies, and this does the next 4, and this does the adding, something along those lines. I can divide up the work. But then I can put them in separate stages so I can be starting on the second one while the first one is still working. Just like any other pipeline.
But if there is only 1 physical ALU, how can I do A2 and A1 at 1 time?
It is a 3-stage ALU. It is a pipelined ALU. The same way my processor can be running multiple pipeline instructions at once, my ALU can be running multiple pipeline multiplies at once. Yes?
Put like arbitrarily complex units of logic in the
Absolutely. We can put it as complicated as we want. So, for example, the integer divide in your processor will take at least 4 cycles, but might take 30 cycles. It's got some pipelining, so it's got an issue every so many cycles, and it also might stall and keep things in place. It's quite complicated. And it just sits there along with everything else. And because of our renaming and our instruction queue, we just don't care. It'll just do the right thing. We can treat it independently of all of its other pieces. Okay. All right, let me just briefly go through this. We're not going to finish this because I just want to get to a little bit of code. All right, so as I think about this, if I think in sort of in cycle one, what can we do? I have ALUs with different behaviors, add, compare, jump versus multiply, start, and end. This is a two-stage multiply with a pipeline in between. And so my first instruction, ALU, the instruction one, one and two, that's ready. So it's going to go into one of the add, jumps, and so forth. 4 and 5 are ready, so I'm going to put that in the start of my multiply. 3 is not ready, so I can't do my other multiply, nor is there more space. I do have another compare, though. 3 and 8 are not ready. 1 and 3 are not ready. 11 and 13 are not ready. And my two condition codes are not ready. So this is all I can do. I don't have anything to do in these two stages. In my next stage, my add has finished. Meanwhile, I have pipelined my second instruction. My first integer multiply has been pipelined down into the second stage of multiply. So I can start a new multiply in this stage because my ALU part one is now available. And instruction three is ready, so I'm going to pop instruction three in here. However, only instruction one finished, so this has become ready. But the writing destination of 2 has not yet. It will not until stage 3. So I'm not going to get 6 ready until stage 3 when instruction 2 retires. Questions? Yes?
How much sooner or how soon is the destination ready after it's executed?
So here I'm assuming we have perfect forwarding, so the moment the execute is done, the data is available. You're welcome. Yes? Great question. Can I put instruction 6 into ALU1? Yes, because 1, 2, and 3, 1 and 3 are both ready, so I could put instruction 6 there. Anything else I can put in ALU1? Can do compares, but I don't have 8, I don't have 11, I don't have 13, so that's the only one I can put there now. But later on, I'll get to a point where I could use both of these. I do want to get to some coding, though, in our last 15 minutes, so we're going to pause here on this. What does this all mean for you? You write code. Remember this code? We spent too long talking about this code last time. Right? It was a simple code, and we talked about how we could take this code, we could add multiple accumulators, we could add unrolling. By unrolling the loop, we now have less loop overhead. And we saw that the result of that, and we saw the result of that was that we could get better performance, but it sort of maxed out. But now we realize there's another trick we can play. I can remove data dependency. So this code, let's compare this code to the code before. Here I have my unrolled code. Here I have my other code. I have added 2 accumulators instead of 1. Why would I do that? Yeah?
Can you guess that, now you don't have to wait for the first add to finish? To get the second add, you can do both in parallel?
Yeah. Note that sum 1 and sum 2 will go map to different physical addresses. So here, both of these sums are going to map to the same physical address. The second sum source will be the first sum's destination, creating a physical, creating a dependency between them. But here, the first sum and second sum have distinct sources and destinations. No data dependency, I can execute them both in the same cycle. And so this idea of having multiple accumulators, is the name our textbook gives to it, having two accumulators or four accumulators, some several accumulators, typically combined with some level of that equal level of unrolling, will allow us to have the hardware run things in parallel using these physical registers, no dependency. Yes? So notice, yeah, because this is a plus equals, this acts very much like the add operator. It's a source and a destination. Right? And so because this instruction has source and destination, they're distinct from this operation, which was not the case here, right? The destination of this was a source of that. So there's a data dependency with one accumulator, there's no data dependency with two. And so this is the idea. And of course I could add more multiple accumulators. So we have had our unrolling. And we noticed it capped out. It capped out this one instruction per element. That was guaranteed by the data dependency. It's guaranteed because each new step has a data dependency on the step before. So no amount of instruction level parallelism, no amount of fancy hardware can make that go faster. But if I throw in multiple accumulators, I can do better. So here is, again, Professor Rice's timing of 16 levels of loop unrolling and various numbers of accumulators. Okay? And as we look at this, we see at first, well, we get below one. That's great. We're getting almost two operations per cycle. Not quite, though, because this is 0.57, not 0.5. Where did the 7 come from? This is the fact I only unrolled 16 times. Only 16. Oh, no. My loop overhead adds 3 instructions every 16 steps. And so that is my extra 3/16 being added in there. I think there's a little bit of parallelism in there, so it might be a tiny bit lower than that. But it's in that neighborhood, right? It's this adding in this loop overhead. And so more unrolling might reduce that 7 closer to 0. At some point you say, getting a 10% speed increase, is that worth my doing? Maybe. Getting a 2%? Probably not. You make your own decision here, right? We also see that if we get enough unrolling, things slow down. We're actually doing less work if we have more accumulators. I have not changed level of unrolling, so this is not caused by having instruction cache misses or the like. I have the same number of instructions, just more accumulators. So let's think about how this would happen. Here I have a bit of C code and a bit of assembly as I'm thinking about my multiple accumulators. If I want to continue this pattern in my assembly up to 16 separate sums, which is where we started seeing a big problem, what will the compiler have to do? Where will the problem come? Let's just try to write the next line. And maybe this will help us understand what's going on. So clearly I have 16, offset the array there. What register should I put it in? I need a new one because it's multiple accumulators. So I need a new register. So I have to pick an unused register. I don't know. How about R8? How long can I keep doing that? Just adding a new register? Until I run out. Actually, less than that, because I've got a stack pointer I need to keep and some way of getting back to the base address and various other things. So what happens is, when I ask my compiler to do it, I eventually get to code like this. I am storing the values on the stack. But I can't use memory accesses both to read and write, so I'm actually writing two instructions. One that is reading the value off of the stack into a register, and the other one that's doing the math and putting it back on the stack. So I have this extra work that I have to do in order to make things work, right? I have to read from the array and then add it to the stack. And so now I have double the number of instructions per step, and there's a data dependency between them, and I've got memory accesses, so possibly cache misses. And so multiple accumulators is limited primarily by the fact I only have 16 physical registers. And it's part of the reason some other more modern instruction sets have more than 16, not physical registers, architectural registers. We'll have 32 or 128 or so on, many more architectural registers so that we can do more of these multiple cumulative kind of work. Yeah? I do have 200 physical registers. You're absolutely right. I have, I think, 192, in fact, in my computer. But this is still the assembly I have to create. This is still what goes to the processor. And the processor doesn't know if I needed it in memory or not. The processor just knows I see this code. And so the processor has to do what my code asks, including reading and writing from memory. Because it can't tell that it was just register spelling into memory versus I actually wanted to write to memory. Okay. So, this then gives us this extra technique, right? We now talked about several different techniques. We have multiple accumulators. We have loop unrolling. We've also talked about cache blocking. We talked briefly for a multiply about reassociation. Each of these will give us a little extra speed. And as we do each of them, other things may become available again. So we saw loop unrolling maxed out pretty quickly by itself. But when I have multiple accumulators, this 7 turns out to be from loop unrolling. It's not going to do a 32-fold loop unrolling. I could get down from 0.57 to 0.54 or something like this. And so as you apply one optimization, another optimization will become available. Yes? So in order to have multiple accumulators, I need to have multiple things handled in parallel, and I can't put that all in one piece of code very easily. So I'm almost always going to have to unroll at least as many as the accumulators I have just to get the multiple accumulators. Okay. So, let's just briefly talk about something your textbook says. Your textbook has a section about how to optimize your code. And then we use diagrams like this. The purpose of this diagram is to take your code and think only about dependencies. So this is the way your textbook might represent the code of an unrolled loop that's summing an array. There are things I have to do. I have to compute some index into my array. I have to see if I've gotten past the end of the array. I'm going to have to keep incrementing. I'm going to have to keep reading from memory. I'm going to have to add them all up together to get my sum. So this is how we might represent the code that we've been talking about. That just loops over an array, but this has some unrolling in it. Because you notice I only have these comparisons every few steps. Okay? But if I try to draw it so I only go down when I have a new dependency, then I get a sense of sort of what's the maximum speed I can expect. Right? First, I have a width. Do I have enough operators, enough pieces of my CPU to do that many things in parallel? But then I also have this depth, which is sort of like the latency bound, that minimum time I can do because of the data dependencies. And this will not give me exact timings, but it'll give me a pretty good idea of timings. And so then, if I think about multiple accumulators, here's what it looks like. I am checking sort of two indices that are going up by twos. I'm doing my sums in two separate sums in parallel and have one at the end. And so I can compare how this scales the size of the array compared to the other one and get a pretty good sense of the likely outcome of performance. So your textbook talks about a lot of different operations using this abstraction. I find them personally quite valuable when I need to make my code go faster. I come back to the textbook for this class for that purpose, even when I'm not teaching this class. There's power in understanding this abstraction, and the various optimizations that it will give you will actually make your code faster. And that is the time we have for today. Next week, I believe Professor Rice will be back. Thank you all for your time.